Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Andrea Bernstein, sitting in for Brian Lehrer. The war crimes case against Osama bin Laden's driver, Salim Hamdan, goes out to the military commission jury today in Guantanamo. We're going to check back now with New Yorker magazine writer Jane Mayer, who's covered the Bush administration's response to the terrorist attacks on 9/11, most recently in her new book, The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. Welcome back to the show.
Well, great to be with you again.
Now, Jane, we've heard a lot today. Closing arguments are coming. The trial is wrapping up. But this really isn't a trial as we know it. Can you explain what it is that's going on and how it came to be?
Well, this is kind of the result of the ad hoc process that was set up right after 9/11 when the Bush White House wanted to declare detainees in the war on terror neither criminals nor prisoners of war. They became something called illegal enemy combatants, a whole new status of accused person, and they had very few rights as compared with any other status of accused person. And this is the process that they were given finally to see whether they're guilty or not. And one of the things that makes these military tribunals different is that if the accused person is found innocent and acquitted, they can still be held for life down in Guantanamo. So it's kind of a trial where either way you lose, basically.
Sounds like Kafka.
Well, you said it and I didn't, but there's certainly plenty of people around the world who think that as much as Salim Hamdan, the driver for bin Laden, is on trial, so is the United States justice system on trial down in Guantanamo to see whether this is really a fair process or not.
Now, just explain what you said. I mean, what is the point of having this tribunal at all if the suspect or the defendant in the case has no different outcome?
I mean, heads you lose and tails you lose. I guess that...
heads I win, tails you lose. I think you meant to say...
Yeah, well, either right, exactly, exactly. So, you know, I guess what they are trying to do is to establish guilt and show that Al Qaeda are war criminals. This is the first war criminal case since World War II, but it's really a newfangled form of justice down there because unlike the last and the most famous war crimes trials were the Nuremberg trials, and they did not wind up trying Adolf Hitler's chauffeur. They tried major figures in the Nazi movement for command authority in which the commanders were responsible for massive deaths and abuses and horrors. And here what we've got is basically kind of a gopher on trial. And one of the most important questions in this particular trial of Hamdan is what level of knowledge did he really have about Al-Qaeda? Was he truly a conspirator and an important member of this criminal enterprise, or was he just, you know, somebody who knew how to fill up the gas and fix the tires? And the reason that we're looking at this low-level suspect is that under the Military Commissions Act, which Congress passed, they redefined what a war crime is in a whole new way. And they gave a very broad definition of what war crimes could be compared to what they were during the Nuremberg period, so that a war crime could be now somebody who is involved in even the most peripheral part of a conspiracy. And basically what you're looking at with Hamdan is somebody who's on the periphery of a conspiracy.
Now, given what you said about how the U.S. justice system is as much on trial as is Hamdan, why would the U.S. pick a sort of relatively low-level person, you know, and even if their case is proven and he's found guilty as charged, he still isn't being accused of masterminding any attacks. Why would they choose strategically to have this first trial of him?
Well, I think that they thought that it would be an easier case than some of the more major figures. And the reason partly that it's an easier case, again, is something that is kind of Kafkaesque, which is that Hamdan, this driver, realized he was in hot water after he had been picked up by U.S. forces. And he thought that in order to help himself, he should cooperate with the interrogators. And so he gave them a lot of information about his role and about al-Qaeda. And what he wound up doing then is incriminating himself. And under most U.S., under U.S. criminal law, if somebody's captured, they and questioned, they're read their Miranda rights and told that, you know, anything they say might be used against them, and they have a right to a lawyer. But because the military commissions are don't observe those rules, they could use these statements that Hamdan gave against him. So he self-incriminated himself and gave them the material they needed in order to try him, and it made it an easier case for them because he gave them enough rope to hang him with, basically.
And that would be the usual script in a regular trial. That a lower-level person might cooperate in the hopes of, and prosecutors would use a lower-level person to get to a higher-level person.
Right.
But what are the rules of this tribunal? Just remind us how it's
well,
working.
Well, basically, if in a criminal trial, you would not be able to coerce somebody into incriminating themselves. Somebody, an accused person, can take the fifth and not incriminate themselves, and they have the right to remain silent. These detainees do not have the right to remain silent. He was forced into incriminating himself in some ways in which the judge in this case decided that it crossed a boundary and that it violated the sort of conscience of the court. And so they couldn't use some of the statements that were literally wrung out of him. And there were photographs of him with military people having him in a hammer hold as he was being questioned in Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan. And so some of that was thrown out. But basically, much of what he has given them, even without Miranda rights, can be used against him. And so it will be.
Now, he is accused of, even though he wasn't accused of masterminding, he was accused of being part of this terrorist plot. Can you explain what the case is against him?
Right. When he was picked up, he was driving one of the al-Qaeda cars, and in the trunk were surface-to-air missiles. So he had, you know, was caught red-handed, I guess you could say, with weapons on him. And so one of the charges against him is giving material support to terrorists by having these weapons that might be able to shoot down American planes with him. The case also involves information that he supplied himself again, in which he said that he overheard bin Laden talking after 9/11 about how happy he was that they'd been able to murder even more people than he'd ever dreamed of in New York and in Washington, that bin Laden had estimated in advance that there might be 1,500 people that they would murder, and in fact they killed nearly 3,000. And bin Laden was happy about that, and Hamdan has told interrogators that he overheard this, which then, again, because it can be used against him, is being used to say that he was wittingly part of a murderous operation.
But even if you were tried in the U.S. courts and you were simply the driver, you could be indicted and found guilty of conspiracy to murder if a murder actually occurred.
But again, in the past, what's been different is in a war crimes case, conspiracy is not usually part of what can be charged against soldiers, because all soldiers in all wars conspire together to fight together against a common enemy. And so conspiracy has not been, for instance, again, why there were not war crimes charges of conspiracy against the driver of Adolf Hitler. Usually war crimes trials are used for major charges against major figures in a war, and not against the sort of the small fry, which is something you might see in a criminal case where somebody's caught a plea deal in the United States criminal courts. So this is, I think, one of the things that either way, whatever the outcome is in this case, that definition of conspiracy is very likely to be appealed on the next level, because traditionally it's not been a war crime to conspire with your side in a military operation.
My guest is Jane Mayer. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker and author of The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. This is Andrea Bernstein in for Brian Lehrer. We're talking about the trial, which wraps up today, against Osama bin Laden's driver, Salem Hamdan, in Guantanamo Bay. So who makes up the judge? Who makes up the jury? How is the case decided?
Well, there were 13 potential jurors that were chosen, and they are all top military officers. And the judge too is a top military officer. So one of the criticisms from the human rights community has been that the prosecution seems to be both judge and jury and prosecution in this case, and that's something that's being watched by many. I wanted to bring up also, possibly because I thought it was very interesting, two of the witnesses who have popped up in this case since last week when we last talked. One was a statement from Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who is thought of as the mastermind of 9/11 and certainly, I think, an undisputed major terrorist figure, who gave a statement on behalf of Hamdan on the defense side, saying he wasn't, he almost was snotty about it. He basically said, you know, this driver is low life. He's a Bedouin. Sounds very, you know, kind of racist about this. He's an uneducated Bedouin, and he would not be somebody who we would consider a major al-Qaeda figure. He's sort of saying he's not up to our level of you know, being operators. And so the defense has used that. And then another witness
this is somebody who's actually accused of being high up in the terrorist organization. So how credible is a statement from him going to be?
The credibility of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is going to be a huge issue, and is already a huge issue. The Bush administration has been all over the map on this. You've got George Tenet, the former director of the CIA, claimed that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed gave them the very best information they got on al-Qaeda. Some of the people in the CIA have portrayed Khalid Sheikh Mohammed as almost an advisor to the United States government on the subject of al-Qaeda. Yet Khalid Sheikh Mohammed has told the Red Cross investigators, when they privately spoke with him, that he made up a whole lot of things, and that he, in fact, among the stuff that he made up, he said and kind of took pride in having made up, were false terrorist threats to the United States that got us to elevate the threat level in this country and sent our government officials on wild goose chases. So, he's a megalomaniac. He's a homicidal, you know, mass murderer. What is his credibility like? I think, you know, certainly it's not great.
Right, so it must be tough for the defense to introduce him as a witness or a statement of his as in their defense. You mentioned another witness that came up.
But I think at the same time, if the government dismisses his credibility in this case, they may have a hard time bringing the case against Khalid Sheikh Mohammed that they went to on the base of things Khalid Sheikh Mohammed told them.
Or against other people.
Or against other people, because they've used him as a major resource. And then the other person I think is very interesting, who's not gotten very much attention, maybe because very little is known. At some point, the judge cleared everybody who did not have a classified top security clearance out of the court, and they brought in a man named Colonel Morgan Banks, who is a psychologist with the U.S. Army Special Operations Command. And he is part of a little-known program that's been key to this whole interrogation program called the SEER program, which stands for Survival is Evasion, Resistance, Escape. He's one of the psychologists who somehow seems to be involved in having taken communist methods of interrogation that were studied by the Special Operations Command and used them to break down U.S.-held detainees in this ironic sort of twist where America wound up copying the communists in how it's treated and interrogated detainees in the War on Terror. And I would love personally to know what Morgan Banks testified to, because his role in this has been quite mysterious. But unfortunately, one of the other ways that this trial is different from regular American criminal trials is the witnesses can be cleared out of the courtroom. The press can be cleared out, and these trials can be held in secret with secret evidence.
And I understand, in fact, during the course of the trial, some of the reporters were watching it on closed-circuit television because there wasn't enough room in the courtroom, and that the camera was not on the witnesses. And I understand one reporter said, well, in United States of America, witnesses are public, and they were told by a military official, this is not the United States of America.
This is not the United States of America. Of course, that is also in contention. I mean, so much of this is just it's kind of being made up as they go along, because basically the Supreme Court has ruled that Guantanamo, for all intents and purposes, is part of the United States. It's the Bush administration has always argued that it's not, and so that it's beyond the reach of United States law. But as we've seen, the court has weighed in again and again and said you've got to give some kind of rights to these people and give them access to U.S. courts, because whether it's part of the United States or not, it's definitely under U.S. control.
Is there anything in this trial that has surprised you in terms of openness? And are there any ways it's more open or more like a trial than you would have expected?
Well, I think that it's good that they've been able to get a statement for the defense from Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. It was unclear whether other detainees in Guantanamo would be able to serve as witnesses or not. I think one of the debates in reading about what some of the people who are down there have been saying, and in particular there's somebody down there from the American Civil Liberties Union who's been saying, it's almost worse to have something that looks like a real trial and is not a real trial than no trial at all, because it gives the appearance of justice, but it doesn't actually deliver real justice. So it's, in a way, kind of more confusing. But I don't know. We will see. We'll have to see what the verdict is. I think most people expect that Hamdan will be, pretty quickly convicted. And then the likelihood is that whatever verdict there is, if there is a conviction, it will be appealed, and this thing is only just beginning. One thing I'd like to say from having written about this subject is that these methods of interrogation and this system of justice that was concocted by the Bush administration were supposed to be shortcuts to be able to get us to win the war on terror faster than the U.S. justice system allowed for. And in fact, everything has taken 10 times as long. You've had people tried and convicted in American courts and put away for life much, much faster than anybody's even gotten in front of a military tribunal down there in Guantanamo.
Jane Mayer is a writer for The New Yorker magazine, and right before we go, I am curious. I have heard Barack Obama say repeatedly, it's one of his biggest applause lines, that he wants to close down Guantanamo. John McCain has certainly expressed reservation about the way certain aspects of the U.S. justice system have gone since 9/11. What happens after November to Guantanamo and to the prisoners there?
Good question. I mean, everybody says, as you say, that they want to close Guantanamo. But part of the problem, there have been all of these unintended consequences of the Bush administration's experimentation with new methods of interrogating, detaining, and trying people. And one of them is, it's very hard to know what to do with these prisoners now. Some of them have been, for all intents and purposes, tortured. And they could not be tried in a U.S. court because a defense lawyer would get them off the hook, even though they may be dangerous. So we also have found a hard time figuring out where to, how to get rid of these detainees at this point. If they were acquitted, most other countries that they've come from don't want them back, and the United States doesn't want them in the mainland. And yet, because of the kind of country we are, we can't just hold people with no rights forever. So it's going to be a real dilemma.
We'll have to leave it there with New Yorker magazine writer Jane Mayer. Her new book is The Dark Side. This is The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. I'm Andrea Bernstein, sitting in for Brian. Up next, Walmart's playing an increasing role in the presidential election. We'll tell you how.